This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We've gone from a time when every radio station used to air hours of religious programming on Sunday morning to a time when most air none. The big questions remain, however, begging for answers, and that's where Krista Tippett comes in. She's host of Public Radio's On Being, which you can hear here on WFAE at 7 on Sunday mornings. Each week, she ponders questions of faith, spirituality, religion, science, and more with listeners who run the gamut from highly devout to atheist. One of those listeners wrote to me when she heard about Krista being with us today. Through listening, she wrote, I have learned that my life does indeed have a spiritual side that I am not always aware of. On Being demonstrates that spirituality exists on every level of our existence. And that's what we'll explore this hour with Krista Tippett, journalist, author, Peabody Award winner, and radio host. She joins us here in our Spirit Square studio for the hour. Welcome to Charlotte.
I'm loving being in Charlotte. Thanks.
Well, you would, because you're from Minnesota, and it's warm here. The trees
right.
are blooming.
It's a little warmer here today than it is in Minnesota.
Well, I'm glad that you're with us. You begin all of your programs when you have a guest that you've never met with a question, the same question about their childhood religious upbringing.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you do that?
Thank you for asking that. I thought you were going to ask me about my childhood religious upbringing. But, you know, I do that. So let's just say the most off-putting question you could ask anyone, including the most devoutly religious person, is, tell me about your religious life now. Are you a religious person? That is an impossible question to answer. On the other hand, the question of the spiritual and religious background of your childhood, we all have one. Even hardcore atheists have. There's usually a very interesting answer to that question. But more importantly, I ask the question because it plants us in a part of ourselves which was searching and certainly softer than we usually are in media spaces. And as I say, everyone has a story. Everyone, you know, they don't even necessarily realize they have a story until you ask that question. And often in that time of life, people started asking questions that they have ended up pursuing the rest of their lives.
What's the most interesting or surprising story that you've heard somebody tell you?
Answer to that? You know, they're all good. I'll give you two examples. Like, you know, Robert Coles, the great child psychiatrist who studied the spiritual life of children, talked about his memory of that was his mother took them to church, his father stayed in the car. Right? And I was, that's a story a lot of people. There's a lot of that. But it was, you know, his wondering why did his father stay in the car and that tension between them that became part of his curiosity. For example, and another story would be a Buddhist, Tibetan Buddhist monk, Mathieu Ricard, who was raised by, his father was one of the great atheist philosophers of France. And there was absolutely no religious background in his childhood, right? So initially he was a bit stumped by this. And then he started recalling his uncle, who sailed around the world, circumnavigated the globe, was an explorer. Also not religious, but on these trips, he took along all the great books of philosophy and spirituality and the great mystics. And he told Mathieu about these books. They had conversations about them. So, you know, that, in fact, was a very rich milieu, as he was atheist, went on to become a cell biologist, but eventually started asking spiritual questions and became a Tibetan Buddhist monk.
You are the daughter of a Southern Baptist minister who, after studying history at Brown University, how that happened, I don't know.
It was a fluke. No one was impressed where I came from. They'd never heard of it.
And then you went to Cold War Europe, mm-hmm. where you were a journalist, and then ultimately became part of the diplomatic corps just before the wall fell. And then you traveled through Spain and England, I guess, after quitting your job, and then decided to go to Yale Divinity School, which seems to me to be somewhat full circle in terms of starting with Southern Baptism and then go to Yale Divinity School. Was it a desire to return to your roots, or had something sparked in you as a result of working in Cold War Germany?
In some ways, I realize in hindsight that working in Cold War Germany was a perfect place to kind of transplant the the grand energy I'd grown up with about dividing the world into good and evil and sin and salvation, you could kind of transpose that onto the geopolitical sphere in the Cold War days. So I would almost say now there was kind of a religious passion behind my political ideals at that point. But I, at a very young age, ended up literally sitting around the table with people who were moving missiles around on a map of Europe, people who were genuinely powerful. And starting, to my own surprise, to ask some questions about what that power really meant, looking at lives of dignity and intimacy that I saw ordinary people creating without power, without wealth, without even many choices, even on the eastern side of the Berlin Wall, and seeing lives of inner impoverishment at that level of high power, and starting to ask myself where I wanted to place my energy. Going to divinity school to study theology was my attempt to see if I could apply the life of the mind and how complex I knew the world to be, to being a religious person again and to taking religion seriously in the world. I had to know that I could do that, mm-hmm. to return to this. I was very surprised myself to start asking spiritual, what I eventually called spiritual questions, in that geopolitical canvas.
What do you mean by inner impoverishment?
I mean, it is possible, and I think we see a lot of this in our culture, to have very big outer lives, to have lives of external accomplishment, and not to invest substantially in who we are as human beings, you know, what our intimate relationships are like, how we are serving the world, how we are doing things like love and compassion and kindness. And I also know that as people draw towards the ends of their lives, they're often haunted by this gap. This does come back to get us at some point. And I was asking in my 20s the kinds of questions a lot of people ask in their 20s. And I think 20-year-olds now as intensely as ever before. They want their lives to have purpose. The rules and the goals that were given as the best you could do even a generation ago don't work anymore. And people want their lives to have meaning, and they want to figure out what that would look like.
Does that require religion or simply introspection?
It does not require religion. And some of the most ethically engaged people I know are not religious people. But our traditions, our religious and spiritual traditions, are repositories, these ancient repositories that have carried these questions and texts and stories and rituals and you know, theological traditions of a rigor of questioning across centuries. And so these are places we dig into and turn to. They are resources, and I think they should be resources in our culture, even for atheists and agnostics.
Krista Tippett is our guest. She's the host of On Being, which you can hear here Sunday mornings at 7. It's a nationally syndicated public radio program about spirituality and faith and religion and all kinds of human things, actually, because you talk about humans as much as you talk about God.
Yeah, well here's what I've come to say. The show has really evolved over time, and what I came to understand is that that what interests me are the animating questions that gave rise to our traditions. What does it mean to be human? How do we want to live? You know, those are the questions that have animated philosophy and theology across the centuries. And as I said, our traditions are great sources of wisdom about that and wrestling with it. But those questions are not exclusive to the religious, right? Those are human questions. Those questions belong to us all. And right now, in an age where religious identity is as fluid as it has ever been, and the world is as in flux as it has ever been, I think there is a more general, broad, expansive longing to take up those questions and to take them up with different others.
You worked after attending a Yale Divinity School for a while with a group of Benedictine monks at St. John's Abbey in Minnesota, where you discovered the power of engaging with theological questions by simply looking at our lives, your lives. Mm. How so? I mean, explain that.
Okay. Well, they had this this way of dialogue, which I would say in some ways I've translated into radio, which is you might sit around a table and you might have a big theological question. And I mean, and it could be a question like, what is prayer or who is God? Answer the question through the story of your life. I propose this as an exercise for any kind of group. It's absolutely fascinating. And that's what fascinates me. I sometimes say, like, what I'm tracing in my conversations is that intersection between big ideas and real life, between theology and human experience. That is not only, you know, what I'm interested in is none of this in the abstract. You know, how do these questions and traditions infuse real lives in many disciplines? And how do our lives and our experiences, both professional and personal, flow back into our sense of meaning and our sense of theology, if we have one? And it's not only that that's a fascinating line to walk across, it makes a discussion about those kinds of things listenable. It makes it listenable to people who are in very different places along the spectrum. But when you humanize doctrine, when you pin these things down to the earth and make them three-dimensional and put it into story and narrative, then it becomes something that we can connect on, across differences. That's a big thing to me.
I mentioned at the beginning of the program that in the old days, every radio station in the country just about carried religious programming on Sunday morning. That's how I got my start playing.
Did you?
Playing records for Tex Asbury's gospel favorites.
Okay.
in Rockville, Maryland on Sunday morning. He was the host, and I just queued up the records, and he gave us donuts. but now nobody carries, just about no radio station carries.
Mm-hmm. Unless it's a religious radio station, which only does that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And yet we do, and your program is aired on public radio on about
250
stations. 250 mm-hmm. stations on this, what some people would refer to as the godless public radio dial. How do you explain that, that public radio gave you entree to discuss these issues?
Well, I have to first say that it was a hard sell.
Was it really?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. There were lots of skeptics, and there still are skeptics, and there still are skeptics in newsrooms. In the latter half of the 20th century, not before, we tried to compartmentalize this aspect of life and keep it contained around the edges or contained to an hour on Sunday morning. That's not sustainable. And then when it breaks back into public life, as it started to do in all kinds of places after like the 1970s, 1980s, 1990s, it's very messy. Mm-hmm. And it's the loud, strident voices who get there first. And then they kind of send the religious people back into their corners even more deeply because they don't want to be associated with that. But the fact remains, you know, what I'm talking about is this part of life where we are asking questions of meaning and purpose, and we are asking those questions in the thick of our successes and our failures, in health and in death, and that is a universal human experience.
We have to take a break. We'll come back with more of our conversation with Krista Tippett, host of On Being, heard here Sundays at 7 on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Hickory Choral Society presenting their 35th spring concert at First Baptist Church, 339 2nd Avenue Northwest in Hickory, Sunday at 3 p.m. HickoryChoralSociety.org and Protect-A-Deck, deck maintenance and restoration since 1998, including pressure cleaning, sealing, and staining of decks, fences, playsets, and more. Estimates at 704-541-8411. Well now, spring and summer bring out a wanderlust in people. The trees are budding. That means spring is on the way. So we're going to explore the state of North Carolina tomorrow. All that Old Salem has to offer, which takes us back to our colonial roots. And we'll meet someone who's hiked 1,000 miles from the mountains to the coast and talk about what she discovered along that hike tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, President Obama travels this week to Israel, Palestinian territories, and Jordan. Critical issues for the U.S. in the region.
Join the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon right after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest is Krista Tippett, host of On Being, heard Sunday mornings at 7 here on WFAE, who believes her radio program and programs like hers, if there are any, which I don't think there are, about the spiritual and intellectual content of faith can open minds, imaginations, and enrich public life. Is that kind of what you're trying to offset, what we just talked about prior to the break, this angry
yes.
conversation?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for bringing that up. Because, yeah, one of the things I was aware of 10 years ago when I first started the show is, the spiritual content and substance of faith was getting lost in the politicization of religious voices. Mm-hmm. And also that there is intellectual, thrilling intellectual content to this part of life. And what I wanted, and again, this was hard to argue in the beginning in the abstract, but I said public radio is a place where we should be able to cover this important part of life with its intellectual content, with its spiritual content, with all the values that we apply to our coverage of politics or economics or the arts. There was a sense back then that, and this was because we only had examples of this, that if you put these voices on the air, they would be proselytizing, inflammatory, mm-hmm. exclusive. But in fact, that's not true of the lived religiosity of most people. So I really felt like this is too important for us not to try to create some new ways to bring these ideas and these perspectives.
So the angry, squeaky wheels were getting all the press. And they were
absolutely.
Trying to bring-
yeah, and I would also give some credit to journalists for that. You know, those were easy. Those are the voices that throw themselves in front of microphones, and it's really easy to hand them the microphone, and you get your headline, and you get your great tease. You get your entertainment value. But what you weren't getting was a reflection of this part of life.
You said these intellectual conversations could be thrilling.
Yeah.
How so?
I mean, I was at Queen's University last night talking about science and religion. I interview a great number of physicists and biologists and, you know, linguists and people working in the varied sciences. Science is asking questions of why and in terms of how. Religion is asking questions of why in terms of purpose. I do think of this part of life as exploration. You know, this is about inner discovery. It's about inner discovery, and I think I haven't probably emphasized this enough in this. It's also about who we are to each other. It's about service. It's about understanding our well-being. This is something that our traditions have known forever. As in fact being very much linked to the well-being of others, of strangers, of the outcast, of the poor, of that person across the planet. In the 21st century, that is a reality, you know, not just of flourishing, but of survival. So that's again where I see these traditions as repositories of virtues and practices and realities.
You know, that is a could be if you took away the word religion out of everything you just said
yeah.
and made it political. You'd be way on the left. You'd be a way out wacko.
Tell me what that would. What would I say that would be on the left?
Well, just the fact that you are concerned with the welfare of the poor.
Oh, but others. Yeah.
Well, but I'm just saying yeah. that if you take religion out of that, it becomes a liberal leftist point of view. And yet the loudest voices in the religious conversation mm-hmm. seem to be conservative Christians. I could be wrong about that, but it just seems that way, maybe because of the way journalists handle that. And if you take religion out of their views and just make it political, they're on the right. How do you put the two together? If you're a contemporary Christian
mm-hmm.
and devoutly so, and you align yourself with the right, how do you then align yourself with what you just said?
So I really do veer away from politics because
if you
align yourself with the gospel, mm-hmm. let's just speak in Christian terms, and this is something that many conservative religious people do and consciously do, there is a love of the stranger, a love of the poor, a love of the outcast, a love of the enemy. It is true that the religious voices that, again, have most effectively marketed themselves and squeezed themselves into political boxes in order to be heard have often not represented that. But, there are so many Christians who know that, and conservative Christians. Mm-hmm. It's just that, and that's really what I'm committed to drawing out and shining some light on, is that spectrum. There are also a lot of, there's this really interesting movement today among young evangelicals who really just don't fit into the boxes. They may look conservative if you want to put it into political categories on social values issues. They may look extremely liberal when it comes to social justice issues. You know, they're just as concerned about poverty and the environment and sex trafficking as any strident leftist. So it's that, you know, it's allowing us to take each other out of boxes and be human beings together. Mm-hmm. And letting those differences exist, our differences are what make us interesting to each other, right? There's value in that. I don't think we want to get rid of that. I do think there's a real longing on some of these grand issues of our time, which politics has not paid so much attention to. Poverty, the environment. How we structure the matter of work in our time, how we think about meaning and vocation, how we structure our communities and bring them back to life in this technological age. If we politicize those things, we just impoverish ourselves. We impoverish our public life altogether.
You do, and of course, the whole reason you do the program is to explore lots of questions and find answers. And the answers don't always agree from week to week, or even from guest to guest, I would imagine, because everybody has different answers that are their own. There are some faith traditions that encourage conversations like this, that encourage questioning of scripture and of tradition to try to find answers that work. Other traditions don't allow for any questioning. It is black and white. It is there. It's what God said in the Bible, and every word is true. How do you approach questions with people like that?
Yeah, and my grandfather, I grew up in that world, and my grandfather definitely, I think, took a literal reading of the Bible. My grandfather had a huge, wonderful mind and a second-grade education, mm-hmm. and my experience of him was, you know, I inherited his Bibles after he died, and they're just filled with notes, and what I experienced in him was a great deal of fear at asking too many questions. And I think that we're very skilled in this culture. We tend to set up our discourse and our encounter with different others in a way that sends people to their extreme hardened positions. And so, you know, my answer to that question is I don't think in terms of opening our public life up to more questions across those chasms, if you will, that is a matter of dialogue. I think that, first of all, we have to learn how to create hospitable spaces where we can all come with our questions. I have to say, liberals are really good at wielding their answers, too. They're just so convinced at the superiority of their answers. they may consider themselves to be more sophisticated in the way they do that. But the dynamic is on both sides, and I'm interested in shaking up that dynamic. And that's about creating, let's say, hospitable spaces.
You mentioned your grandfather had fear at the basis of not wanting to ask too many questions. Do you find fear among liberals who seem to be
absolutely
very self-satisfied with their intellectual superiority?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Look, We live in a moment, a historic moment. We're turn of century people. We are living in a moment where we are throwing up basic definitions that the 20th century thought it had answered. You know, when does life begin? When does death begin? What is a family? What is a marriage? What is authority? What is leadership? Democracy? You know, things that seem to work, how we structure our workplaces, how an economy works, how democracy works. None of this works the way it's supposed to right now. The forms are, and technology is driving all of this, right, at a very rapid pace. This, for us, just physiologically, is stressful for human beings. It's more stressful for some than for others. Those of us who have a lot of education and some financial security are going to be able to handle it a little bit better, just biologically. But we are walking around with a lot of fear. We're walking around, all of us, I think, are walking around with a lot of fear about our children's futures, right? We share that. So one thing we need to acknowledge and just cut ourselves a little slack about is that it's a stressful moment. And this kind of anxiety does not bring out the best in people. It brings out the worst in people. And that kind of fear is often not self-conscious. And it often comes out looking like anger. And I think that in our public spaces where we almost encourage that anger, you know, in our debates, in media, we are setting ourselves up.
It's good for ratings.
It's great for ratings. It's great for sound bites, right? Mm-hmm. Complex, nuanced ideas, questions that admit they don't have all the answers yet, are going to get cut from the tape.
It's very unsatisfying.
It's very unsatisfying. So that's where we are. It's bringing out the worst in all of us.
Larry emails, and I think there's some element of fear in this question. Not in the question, but the answer to the question. I know that religion can do a great deal of good for an individual, but what good is religion for society? For example, is it not the reason or rationale for most wars?
Well, I think that the fact that question can be posed reflects some ways, and perhaps our traditions have failed their own deepest values. At its core, it is absolutely about, these are the only places in our culture where we have these really sophisticated ways to think about the other, to think about the stranger. In the 21st century, those are existential things to think about. Those are matters of survival. I also think, though, that, again, maybe public religion has failed to express that. Politicized religion maybe has failed to express that. One of the ironies of covering this part of life, I think, as a journalist and as a consumer, a citizen watching it, is that the people who are, I think, most deeply and with the greatest integrity steeped in these traditions have this incredible humility about them. So you do. I mean, I'm in Charlotte. I don't know Charlotte, but I know that you have religious people feeding the hungry and caring for the aged and not throwing themselves in front of cameras and microphones to tell us all about it. It's in the nature of living the depths of these things that it's not about external glory. Mm-hmm. It's not about fame. I think that serving the world, I think the young, I experience a lot of young people in their teens and 20s who are discouraged with institutional religion precisely because it has not expressed this, and that their spiritual questions and seeking, you know, they may look disconnected from religion. They may come out in these surveys as the nuns, the N-O-N-E-S, you know, the new non-religious. But in fact, what is driving so many of them is a passion to be of service to the world, to craft lives of meaning that matter, that are not just personally fulfilling, but matter to others.
I don't know if you can answer this question. Does God care? If that's the path you take, this drive to serve the world, does he care or she care? If that's the path you take versus the more traditional, becoming a Catholic, a Methodist, a Jew, a Muslim, does he care? She care? Does God
I
care?
Cannot speak for God. And I think if I did, I would be booted off public radio. Look, all I can say to you is that again, this may not be the most famous part of religion in the late 20th century. But all of these traditions, every single one of them, Christian, Jewish, Muslim, Buddhist, which is not, you know, traditionally theistic, but they at their core, they are about compassion and being and love and being of service to others. It's there in all of them. So
how then
are a reflection of God?
But if that's the fundamental basis of all of these traditional belief systems, how do we arrive at the anger and the vitriol and the hatred that we witness so often?
Because we're human, and because it's scary and vulnerable to be human. And again, as I said a minute ago, it's particularly scary and vulnerable to be human right now. But I do want to say there's the reality that's publicized, and then there's reality of millions and millions of people. I mean, you mentioned Catholics in there, right? I mean, Catholics were behind, so many of our schools and most of our hospitals, and that's true around the world. I mean, this is a great big tradition with long, deep roots. Most of the civic organizations in this country the YMCA, the Rotary Club, I mean, the Chambers of Commerce, they all started out, in fact, as Christian gatherings, and then they secularized over time. Something I think about when I see us at work in other countries, in Muslim countries, and where we're trying to drive Islam out, and not understanding that in our own culture, these moderate, civically active religious people were really the bedrock of our democracy and of what became our more secular civil society. So there's abundant evidence of this, but we have to remind ourselves because we're very distracted by the loud, strident, sometimes incredibly violent voices who use religion.
I want to bring Zach in Cherryville into this conversation. Zach, welcome. You're on WFAE.
Hey, thanks. My question for the guest is basically: do you see your point of view sort of something that's on the rise or may the decline? Because from my perspective from a small town, North Carolina, I sort of see the integration of the political right into the Christian belief system. Like, you almost cannot be Christian without adhering to that politically.
Okay, and, I have less than a minute left in the segment.
I don't know how to measure that. Again, I do know one thing I am on top of is what's happening with young evangelicals, a new generation of evangelicals all over the place, and they are mobilizing. And they definitely don't fit. They don't fit into that. So I would say, if that might be something that is, if that represents what is going to be coming up, I mean, I definitely see some change there.
Zach, thank you for your call. Our guest is Krista Tippett, host of On Being, Sunday mornings at 7 o'clock here on WFAE. And when we come back, I want to take a look at some of the topics, some of the conversations that you've had over the years on that program, and find out how they figure into religion, because some of them are really interesting when you think it's a religious show or a spiritual show. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Audi of Charlotte, presenting a selection of luxury vehicles committed to customer service and satisfaction. East Independence Boulevard inside the 485 Beltway, Audi, truth in engineering information at audiofcharlotte.com. And Nexen Pruitt, lawyers helping companies meet business challenges in court with regulators and at the deal table. With offices in Charlotte and seven other Carolina locations, next challenge, next level, Nexen Pruitt. President Obama travels this week to Israel, the West Bank, and Jordan. Diane Rehm and her guests talk about the critical issues for the U.S. in the region and the discussions that will most likely ensue on his trip. That's coming up at 10 o'clock in 20 minutes. And if you'd like to join our conversation, now's the time. 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or online at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
President Obama will soon visit Israel and the occupied West Bank. That's where an Israeli project would expand settlements and could undermine peace efforts.
We have a lot of children who were raised here, were educated here. Now they want to live in the place that they have been born.
Israel's so-called E1 project, today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
Hey, Credit.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Krista Tippett, our guest, the host of On Being, Sundays at 7 here, Sunday mornings at 7 here on WFAE. Your show used to be called Speaking of Faith.
Yes, it did.
Why the name change?
Well, I would still name it Speaking of Faith if we started in 2003. We had an evangelical president. It was the post-9/11 era. Religion was in the headlines. And I felt like it was really important to... Again, to shine a light on religion with all the breadth and fluidity and diversity that it has in real modern lives. I think that our cultural encounter with religion in these years, our general encounter, is shifting. And I feel like we've been listening to the culture as much as I've been listening to my guests, and there's been kind of this natural evolution. The show didn't change when the name changed. To say Speaking of Faith just wasn't a big enough descriptor of what happens.
And what happens, you use the word listening. And at least for you as the host and the person who asks the questions and provokes the answers, that's what your show is about. And so often it seems to me in these conversations that we have about religion, nobody's listening. Everybody's talking.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
What have you learned through listening?
Can you be a little more precise?
In other words, has it changed your worldview? Has it changed your view of religion or faith or the importance of these conversations? Has it turned out to be as important as you hoped, important than you hoped?
Yeah.
Have you changed fundamentally as somebody who cares about these things?
I think that sometimes I use this biblical phrase that's in the New Testament and also the Hebrew Bible, developing eyes to see and ears to hear. Mm-hmm. So what I've been saying all along about needing to listen beyond the most strident voices, look behind the headlines, look for these lives of beauty and humility and dignity who are living out the depths of these traditions or the depths of their spiritual discernment. Yeah, there's so many people out there that I wish I could get to more quickly. It's been this journey of discovery. Mm-hmm. It's really been an adventure. You know, who I discover, what they're doing. I also interview, as you said in the beginning, a lot of people who are not religious, a lot of atheist scientists, but people right now who are working in fields of physics and neuroscience. You know, they are reframing and reposing the great existential questions of what it means to be human and how we want to live. That's where the raw materials of theology are going to come from in the next century. You know, the language of beauty, an attention to beauty, a reverence for mystery. Those are qualities of modern people that I would say have been so exciting for me, kind of to be infected by, and I think my listeners to be infected by.
John in Matthews, you talked about talking to atheists, and he wants to know what value atheism brings to the conversation.
Well, I do believe that atheists have spiritual lives too, depending on how you define that. Some atheists like that description, some don't. I think that one reason atheists and agnostics enjoy listening to the radio show is because they actually really want to be part of our cultural discussion about moral values issue and even about the things that cluster around religious life. And they have absolutely been excluded in this narrow way, as a lot of religious people have been excluded in the narrow way that it's been polarized and politicized. So that's a way I think I want to invite us in all into these human questions. But as I said just a minute ago, you know, what neuroscientists are learning about religious virtues like altruism and compassion and forgiveness, those things will inform, can more deeply inform what the traditions have known about those things. There's really fruitful, interesting echo and conversation across science and religion right now, which is not about scientists being religious or religious people experiencing these ideas as atheistic. It's about us sharing what we're all learning about the world we live in and about ourselves.
There has always been an uneasy relationship between science and religion dating back to Galileo. And you talk, as you say all the time, with scientists. Mm-hmm. You talked with physicist James Gates about why string theory stretches our imaginations and about the nature of reality. And are we, as humans, in the matrix, which appears, his field of research, appears to push science right to the outer fringes of our concept of God and heaven. How can religion coexist with something like that?
Well, maybe it
does. Not be destroyed by it.
No, maybe it does. But even James Gates, who I don't know how he defines himself religiously, when he starts discovering as a theoretical physicist something that he calls codes hidden inside reality, you know, even he says you can interpret that a number of ways. You can interpret it as science declaring, proving that this is all biological and physical and we're going to figure it out and you don't need God to figure it out. You can interpret it as seeing an ingenious, as Einstein said, mind behind the universe at work. Einstein was not a traditionally religious person at all, but
and you wrote a book on Einstein.
I wrote a book, which is a collection of my conversations with scientists, including some investigation we did of Einstein.
You've also talked about fairy tales.
Yeah, right. Last week's show was on fairy tales, yes.
A recent program on fairy tales about their migration from the world of childhood to adulthood to TV shows like Grimm.
Yes.
And Once Upon a Time, which I love, by the way. True Blood.
Once Upon a Time. Oh, yeah, I do too.
And Game of Thrones, which I also love.
Yes.
Why talk about fairy tales on a program dealing with spirituality and religion? Because some people would say...
Yeah.
Bill Maher, for one, that religion is
a fairy tale. Mm-hmm. Sure. I would think also Bill Maher probably undervalues the importance of... Here's the thing. I actually think Bill Maher is brilliant, by the way. I like his show. I think he's not very smart about religion, but he's smart about a lot of things. We are storytelling creatures. This is another way when I talk about the traditions, Christianity and the other traditions as repositories of wisdom and truth, right? They're full of showing us how to use stories to talk about what matters, to talk about what matters in ways that talking about facts can't reach. And I am fascinated with how we are taking this fundamental human need to tell stories. Sometimes to tell fantastical stories, to understand the darkest, deepest parts of ourselves, our fear, our capacity for violence, our capacity to transcend that violence, that television has become so much more sophisticated about that. What I talked about with Maria Tatar is that the Grimm brothers actually didn't start out to collect tales for children. They were collecting tales that intergenerational groups told around the fire.
And they're very, very scary.
They're very scary.
The original
version.
Yeah,
she said they
not
either
the Disney
burlesque
version.
In their violence. Yeah. Yes. And we turned them into, well, no, the culture at that point did too, but certainly by the time I was growing up when, you know, it's Disney. It's mm-hmm. I mean, it was all for children. And so this is how we lost sight of some of the ways we've always made meaning and tried to understand who we are and tried to understand how we get through this darkness. And we are recovering that. And it doesn't have to be religious. I think it's fascinating that it's not religious, that it's happening in non-religious places. But it is taking us to these same places that religion allows us to go.
Let's bring some folks into this conversation. Melinda in Charlotte, welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning.
Morning. Go ahead.
I just wanted to just thank your guest for kind of speaking about just those people that don't really fit in a box. I guess I kind of, it just was very validating to hear. I am, I guess I consider myself young, but I'm a Christian. I love the Lord. I believe the Bible is true. And I do. I have a passion for injustice and poverty, and I'm on this funny line where when I engage with people, sometimes even from my church or other believers, I kind of get looked down at or, stoned because I vote a certain way or because I'm involved in this program or I don't, you know, put one thing above the other. And then I go to this other side and I'm, you know, at a homeless shelter and volunteering and I'm looking and I'm looked at crazy because I might be, I don't vote this way or, yeah, just kind of feeling like I don't really fit in a box. And yeah, so I just, it was refreshing to kind of hear that. I'm not the only one in the universe.
That makes me really happy. Thank you for calling. And yeah, one thing that we hear a lot from listeners, really diverse listeners, is that listening to the program makes them feel less alone. And I think that does say something about our culture, how we selectively highlight things, and we like it not to be messy, and there not to be ambiguity, and there not to be nuance and complexity. You know, it doesn't make for a good sound bite, but so many of us, this is a complicated time to live in, and we want to figure out how to live lives of dignity and worth, and we don't fit into these boxes, and I want to give voice to that.
Well, Linda, thank you for your call. Marion in Southern Pines, welcome to the program, Marion.
Well, good morning. And Krista, thank you so much for your wonderful program. I love the inclusiveness of it, and your guests are just always fantastic. I was raised Catholic in Raleigh, North Carolina in the 1950s, and my experience was a very negative experience. I know it's different these days, but I don't know, just that experience led me to where I am at this point. It was a long journey and lots of therapy. And I even went to a mega institute for holistic studies in New York for about 6 years, where I was on the staff. And it was just fabulous to be able to be very open to hearing other views, other beliefs, to being with leaders of other faiths and beliefs, and to be, it's for me, it's like the inclusiveness is what I found that I yearned for. And I feel that I'm a very spiritual person, but I'm not a religious person. You know, I don't go to church on Sunday. I don't read the Bible. But I am very involved in social justice kinds of activities. And I think that also I want to just mention it's a simple little thing, but it's just, I think it's so important to embrace your full story of who you are and to recognize others in your daily life as being human beings, like when you go to the grocery store and smiling at the clerk and speaking with and recognizing them and just, you know, little ways every day.
Isn't that kind of what you explore on the show through all these different guests, the fact that you remove doctrine from a lot of these conversations, which allows people to connect?
Yeah, we humanize doctrine. So even if doctrine comes into it, we want to know what that looks like in ordinary life. You know, not to turn these things into abstractions and things that don't resonate in ordinary life. And I mean, that's where it happens. Our lives are the raw materials.
Marion, thank you for your call. I have two emails that are on the same topic, but not exactly the same comment. Bob emails that Christian values are antithetical to the American dream. The Gospels are brimming with the message of community, while the American dream demands fierce independence. And then Gary writes, when I was growing up in the 50s and 60s, religion, particularly Christianity, was far different than it is today. I don't recall ever hearing America described as a Christian nation. Now we hear that constantly, but it seems that money is the prime motivating factor today. For that reason, I've come to believe that we actually live in a godly nation. However, we don't seem to focus much, at least not in our actions, in the God of creation and the Holy Scriptures of the Old and New Testaments. It seems that today that the God of creation has been replaced by the God of materialism. And the Old and New Testaments have been replaced with the United States Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. As the Bible truly says, it isn't possible to serve two masters.
I just can't do that justice in a couple of minutes. I just want to say it is absolutely true that we have meshed these things together, our patriotism, our Christian underpinnings. We've read things back. You know, the founding fathers became absolutely part of the culture wars, and you can read them both ways, and you can pit them against each other. The phrase separation of church and state is not in the Constitution. You know, it's something that evolved through law. Jefferson rejected it, but but Jefferson also cut his Bible up into the parts he liked and the parts he didn't like. It's a very, very complex picture. And I think it would behoove us to take in some of that complexity. Certainly, there was a relationship. The founding fathers believed that some of these truths and virtues and insights of Christianity, I mean, they mostly came from Christianity, were reflected as, you know, as natural law. So that's there, but we don't know it. We've forgotten it.
I only have a minute left, mm-hmm. but I want to talk about the Pope. We've been consumed.
Who is at this moment
being coronated. Yes. But we've been consumed by the abdication of one, the selection and ascendancy of Pope Francis. In a world that is largely Catholic, I think, but not in a country that's not, they moved the newscasts to Rome for a week. Do you understand this interest in the Pope? And why the Pope? Why not the Dalai Lama? Why not Greek Orthodox, head of the Greek Orthodox Church?
Yeah, well, the Dalai Lama is probably the only other comparable world religious leader, but his tribe is much, much smaller. Mm-hmm. The Catholic Church is the mothership of all Christians. That's billions of people.
Would you have said that when your grandfather was alive as a Southern Baptist minister?
I would have said he was the Antichrist, but I won't say that today. I just want to say what I keep thinking about. Just a couple of weeks ago, I interviewed Greg Boyle, also a Jesuit, who said he was drawn to the Jesuits for their mixture of hilarity and prophecy. And I would love to see if those qualities come through in the new Pope.
Because Pope Francis is a Jesuit, Jesuit Pope ever. And the Jesuits have a tenuous relationship with the papacy. Krista Tippett, host of On Being, Sundays at 7 a.m. here on WFAE. Thanks for a delightful hour.
Thank you.